This is Roxanne Farwell of the Smoke Jumpers Oral History Project interviewing Philip Stanley at his home, 7:30 p.m., July 3rd, 1984. First, some biographical data. How old are you?
65 in April, last April.
Okay. And where were you born?
Kaifeng, Honan Province in China.
What was your family's occupation?
Dad was a YMCA missionary working with Chinese students.
And so when did you first come to Missoula?
1943 for the Smoke Jumper program. Middle of May, I think it was, May 15th, 1943.
Okay. And had you done any kind of work before being trained as a smoke jumper?
Any kind of, well, what kind of work?
What was your occupation, if you...
Mainly I'd been a photographer and photo finisher then. Aerial photography also, but primarily photography in its various branches.
Okay. Did you have any firefighting experience?
No.
And had you been working in the CPS previous to?
Yes. We came from Patapsco, Maryland camp, where I'd been about a year, I guess, before we came to California. And we were there about 9 months before we came to Missoula.
Okay. What was the nature of the CPS work that you did previous to becoming a smoke jumper?
Maryland, we were working in a tree nursery, digging up trees and transplanting them. In California, Colville, right on the Nevada border, we were working clearing trail for the Forest Service. Work of national importance, or as the Southerners like to say, national impotence.
Okay. So why did you decide to apply for the smoke jumping positions?
Well, that involves a little history, I guess. I'd heard about the project in California, and I don't remember the source of the information, but I got to badgering our Forest Service engineer there, Ray Briding, to find out more information about it, and he finally gave in and got me the names of people to write, so I did, thinking that we may be able to do something in the way of smoke jumping. He gave me the name of Axel Lynn, who was, what did they call it? Fire chief, I think, here in Missoula. I wrote him. And he responded saying there was some chance they'd be able to use some of us. I also wrote my brother, who was working for the NSBRO, which is what? National Service Board for Religious Objectors, mm-hmm, in Washington at the time. And he started working from the other end with the American Friends Service Committee, and I guess the two-pronged attack paid off, because eventually the Forest Service decided they could use some of us. And luckily enough, I was included as one of the volunteers.
So you were among the first of the COs then to...
Yes, rank. They brought about six or eight of us here in the middle of May 1943 to be riggers, to train as parachute riggers. And I was one of those, yes.
So you trained to be a rigger first, mm-hmm, and then somewhere later you were trained as a jumper?
Yes, I think the rigger training started about 2 weeks ahead of the jump training. We got that first, and then we started jump training after everybody else arrived.
Okay. How many people were in your group when you trained?
Oh boy. You better ask Earl Cooley or somebody that has a memory for figures. I think it was 35 or 40 that first year.
Were they all COs?
Yeah. Except for supervisory personnel, Air Force Service.
When you were toying with the idea of becoming a smoke jumper, did your family have any sort of reaction to that? Did they think of that kind of work?
My family consisted of two brothers who were also COs, a dad and mother who didn't know about it until after the fact. So I don't know quite how to answer that question.
That's fine. What were the advantages to the smoke jumping program that you saw? You know, I guess I'm trying to find out, you expressed an interest in becoming a smoke jumper, but I'm trying to find out why it was you were really interested in that. Because it is pretty hazardous work.
Well, I think that's the key to it. It's probably hard for you to imagine our frame of mind at the time. We had a very popular war going on. We were very unpopular. Mm-hmm. We had to prove ourselves. We had to prove we weren't yellow. We weren't scared. We wanted to do something that was important besides clearing trails. I think it's very basic. It's very, very simple. We had to prove our manhood.
What was involved in your training? I guess start with rigor training.
You mean, oh, the rigor training?
Yeah. What did it entail?
How to pack a parachute, of course. Mm-hmm. Be very meticulous, very careful how to pack it, how to repair them, because they were made of silk at the time. Mm-hmm. Grasshoppers just loved them. If you left them on the ground too long, you'd have hundreds of holes mm-hmm. eaten in them by the grasshoppers. Make sure they were serviceable and packed properly and ready to jump.
Did you pack, as a rigger, were you learning how to pack main chutes? Or I guess I'm also thinking of the reserve chute.
Reserves. Both. Oh, yeah.
What was involved then in your jumper training?
Calisthenics, physical conditioning, exit from the plane, do everything safely, watch out for the other guy, make sure all the equipment was well maintained and serviceable, ready to use. But I think the Forest Service principle was to get you so stiff from physical conditioning that you couldn't even wiggle, and by then you were ready to jump.
I've read about some of the things like mock-ups and letdowns and things like that. Now the letdown was to simulate getting yourself out of a tree.
Tree landings, yeah.
Did these units or these types of training really simulate what you were going to experience?
Oh, yes, very definitely. Of course, we only had two mock-ups because we were only using two planes at the time, a travel air and a trimotor. But they taught you how to get out of the door, how to put your foot on the step, make a decent exit from the plane. And, of course, letdowns taught you how to get out of the tree, which was extremely valuable at times. Mm-hmm. I think the first death occurred in a letdown after the war over in Oregon someplace. I think it was a black man. Of course, they were Negroes at the time. That came to the end of his rope and let it pay out through his harness and fell the rest of the way. So, yes, it's extremely valuable training.
How long did the physical training last?
I don't remember. It seemed like ages, but it was probably only about 6 weeks. As I recall, that first year at Sealy Lake, we were waiting for rain to quit. Waiting for it to dry up enough to jump.
Did At the end of your training session, was there any kind of an initiation period or anything like that to inaugurate you as a jumper? Did the older jumpers put you through any sort of a hazing or anything?
No, I don't recall any experience like that at all. No, we were just so happy to be on the way. We were looking forward, not backward.
And when did you get your firefighting training then?
Oh, well, sure. This is all part of the physical conditioning, running compass courses, learning how to dig a shoestring trench down to mineral earth, and this sort of thing came along with the physical conditioning. Oh, yeah, it was all part of it. Smoke jumping is just another way to get to a fire, in spite of all the glamour that people attach to it. It's just another way to get to a fire.
Kind of an unusual way, but...
Yeah, it was then.
Now, you had practice jumps during your training period, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell me how you felt before the very first practice jump? What were some of the things that ran through your mind when you were getting ready for that?
Scared to death. But I think with all the training we had and all the physical conditioning and then psychological conditioning too, we would have jumped no matter what. On that first one, it's the second and third jumps that get you. It's
oh, yeah?
About that time you begin to think, what the devil am I doing up here? You know, I've proved I can do it. Why practice?
Do you remember anything from the jump? You're in the plane, getting ready to go out.
Just in nothing specific, just an extreme feeling of terror to begin with, and exhilaration after you get out of the plane. Everything is so quiet and serene, and you know you've done it. You've been wondering all this time whether you could or not, and you've finally done it, and what a feeling of relief.
Were you relieved as you were coming down closer to the
yes.
ground and figuring out how to deal with the landing, or was that any problem?
There was lots of time to consider the landing later. You just enjoyed the ride down.
Could you describe for me your first fire jump in as much detail as you can?
First one, I'm not sure I can. I don't think I remember the first one. I remember a couple of memorable ones, but I don't remember which ones they were. Want to hear about those?
Sure. That was my next question.
Oh. Yeah, I think I remember the first one. It was over in Idaho. Jumped with Dave Flaccus and Lyle Zimmerman, I think, and worked about 24 hours on the fire, got a shoestring trench around it, and then were relieved by smoke chasers that came in on foot, and we hiked out to Pierce, Idaho, Ranger Station, Pierce, Idaho. And it looked like a stage set with wooden sidewalks and dirt streets and the whole bit. And the ranger there, I think his name is McDonald, couldn't believe the sight of us. And me mainly, because I was dressed in blue denims, which were work clothes at the time. They weren't fashionable at all. And they were kind of ragged. I'd burned some holes in them, and the cuffs were torn. They'd been patched, and a few things like that. And he really felt sorry for me, and I thought I was pretty well outfitted. So he tried to get me some decent clothes. I mean, decent to his standards.
Uh-huh.
I thought I was well outfitted.
He knew you were a smoke jumper.
Yeah, and we'd done our job. Who cares what we looked like? You know? But he was the salt of the earth. He did his best, and he got us back home over the old Lolo Trail, which hadn't been carved out at the time. It was just a one-lane Forest Service road. But that was the first one. I had a hard time remembering that one. Other jumps stood out much better. Like the one over in Oregon where we landed in 120-foot tall trees. Mm. And some of the boys weren't lucky enough to get to the ground. They hung up right in the tops of the trees. I was still jumping an eagle at the time, which is a lot more steerable, a lot more manageable.
An eagle parachute?
Yes. Okay. We were in the process of switching from eagles to Irvins at the time. Irvin is a spherical canopy. An eagle is much more steerable, but it has a much harder opening shock. So a lot of the guys avoided them, and I can't say as I blame them. But once you open and live through the opening shock, you could put them where you wanted to go, mm-hmm. which I did, and landed on the ground. And some of the guys were still 120 feet up in the air.
And how long is their rope, their letdown rope?
Oh, well, they didn't need a letdown at all. They could climb down the branches, the tree. Except they better have the rope with them. Some of the last branches are still 20 and 25 feet off the ground. They had to let down from the last branch. Yes. And of course, that presented a problem getting them out again because we had to retrieve the chutes. They were not expendable. They were extremely valuable because we couldn't get any more.
Yeah. What happened if you came back without your chutes?
I don't think anybody did. They probably would have been shot right on the spot. You just didn't do that.
What sort of shape were they in after? What was a silk chute in a tree? Did you have to do a lot of repair work on it afterwards?
Surprisingly little. They were very durable. It was very closely woven material, of course, and silk is tough. Mm-hmm. It'll snag and pull, but won't be damaged at all. Speaking of repair, we got a bunch of Army-Navy reject chutes. They were nylon at the time, and Irvins. When was it? Must have been the winter of 44, because we were running so short, that had been rejected by the Army and Navy, and we fixed them up in jumpable condition in our loft down there on Alder Street.
Any other memorable jumps?
For any reason at all?
Sure.
You bet. I don't remember what year it was anymore. I think it must have been 44 or 45. We were jumping on a fire down in Salmon River country. Late in the day, as a matter of fact, two of us had just come back from another jump. And we were supposed to be rotating, and of course that rotation was extremely guarded, extremely jealously. Everybody wanted their chance to jump, and they didn't want to miss it. But two of us had been returned to the Priest Hotel after a jump. We'd just gotten cleaned up, and we were resting on the couch and looking forward to enjoying a couple of days off. When we got a fire call, and the guys that were on call were out at the fairgrounds, right next to the airport, which is Hale Field, of course, at the time, and not available. So what did they do? We'd come back to the Priest Hotel and grab everybody that was available, which included the two of us who had just gotten back. And we weren't about to say no, but our jumpsuits and our parachutes hadn't arrived back yet from the fire. So we scrounged up a couple of outfits. Nothing seemed to fit, but we managed and got off, took off in the trimotor, flew down to the Salmon River country just above Mackey Bar, and jumped late in the day. It was just ready to get dark. It must have been 9 o'clock in the evening. jumped on a fire that was burning in nothing. There didn't seem to be anything flammable on the side of that hill, but it was still burning. It was just goat rock and short grass. Jumped on that fire and worked on it all night long. Asked for a Pacific Marine pump from McCall. Gee, memory's the first thing to go. It's from the base in McCall, Idaho. And I remember the squad leader saying that they couldn't get the Marine pump out that evening to bring it out the next morning. First thing, first light. And they acknowledged, McCall acknowledged the message. So we never got the pump that evening. We had a stream right at the bottom of the hill we could have pumped water out of. That wasn't the message at all. The squad leader said, ship the pump, bring the pump today, or if you can't get it today, forget it. Don't bring it tomorrow. That was it. So we didn't get it that evening. First light the next morning, the travel air came over and dropped us a pump. Well, of course, it was never taken out of the Mandy. It was put right back up on a mule and hauled out. We never got a chance to use it. But after working on it all night long, we got it surrounded pretty well and started to hike out probably about noon the next day to Mackey Bar, where a trimotor was due to pick us up. It must have been 20 or 25 miles downriver to Mackey Bar. So we spent the night along the river. And that country is filled with rattlesnakes, of course. For some reason, I was breaking trail. And we were all dead tired, and I had my head down just looking at the tops of my shoes. And I remember my left foot coming up with a rattler stretched across the trail right where my left foot was going to come down. And I don't ever remember putting that foot down again, but I must have. And the rattler disappeared off into the brush. He didn't want any part of me either. But then we spent the night alongside the stream and worried about rattlers crawling in the bedrolls with us because they seek warmth. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I don't think anybody did. But on the way out, we ran into a poor old farmer down there that had a gorgeous fruit orchard. He had just about everything you'd want. Apricots, peaches, pears, cherries, Lamberts and beans, anything you wanted. It was just dead ripe. He couldn't get it to market. So he said, help yourselves. And we just got in there and made pigs out of ourselves. One poor guy loaded up a box maybe 2.5 feet long of cherries and carried them out on his back, trying to get them home. And jogging down that trail for another 10 miles, they just turned to juice. The back of his legs didn't look very good by the time he got to Mackey Bar, and he had hardly had anything left by the time he got out. But that's the kind of thing you remember. Yeah. Not the danger or the tough job of fighting fire. It's the unusual experiences, the camaraderie sort of thing that stick in your memory.
Any characters that you remember?
Lots of them. Everyone's a character. I love characters.
I run across a lot of nicknames in my reading.
Oh, is that right? Oh, everyone was a character one way or another. Where does that question lead?
You want it to. Can you recall about the longest period that you worked somewhat continuously in fire that you were called out again?
Yeah, sure can. fact, I think it was this just before this Salmon River fire I just described to you. No, it couldn't have been, because we were up at 9 Mile at the time. We were working up at 9 Mile on a hay crew. And if you're familiar with those old horse trucks the Forest Service had, they were huge. They held a whole pack string, 9 mules and a horse, 10 head of stock. 4 men could sit abreast in the cab. 365 horsepower Hall Scott engines in them, I remember that. And we were loading baled hay into these trucks. We were cutting the hay and baling it and loading the bales into the trucks for transport somewhere. I don't know where they went. But a couple of guys would operate the baler. Another would buck the bales over to the tailgate of the truck. Another guy in the truck would take the bale from the tailgate and stack it in the truck. And we'd been doing that all day long, at least all afternoon, maybe all day. And I remember one guy got sick or prostrated with the heat. I don't remember what his problem was, but I doubled that job. I jumped down, put the bale up on the tailgate, and then stacked it in the truck until dinner. We quit for dinner, went to eat, and got a fire call right in the middle of dinner. We didn't get a chance to finish dinner and went and jumped on a fire and worked all night on that fire. Yeah, we were pretty fracked by then.
About how many fires did you work?
Let's see. Probably a dozen altogether. Not very many.
They were all ones that you jumped?
Yes.
Of those, were the smoke jumpers the first ones?
Yeah, everyone I was on, yes.
And were there any that the smoke jumpers were the only ones fighting the fire? Nobody else was able to make it in or got there before you guys?
Well, nobody got there before we did. Of course, that was the whole concept of smoke jumping, to be the first strike force.
Yeah.
But there were other firefighters, oh sure. There were so-called smoke chasers that came in to relieve us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you usually would get the fire under control.
Yeah.
Someone else, the ground crews would come in and then...
would do the mop-up.
Okay.
Right.
Were your jumps mainly in the Montana-Idaho area, or you said you had one in Oregon?
Mainly Montana and Idaho, mainly in the panhandle of Idaho. As I understand it, there's a real lightning belt right through the panhandle of Idaho. That's where I wound up jumping most of the time, yeah. I forgot about your tea. It should be ready.
You mentioned how you were really, it seemed like you really looked forward to being called on a jump, to get the chance to jump a fire. And why was that? Was there extra pay for fires you jumped?
You've got to be kidding. Paid? We weren't paid. You didn't know that? No, there wasn't any pay involved. We had a $2.50 allowance per month. There wasn't any pay involved in jumping. You know. I think it was what I described earlier. It's proving our manhood. We wanted to be able to do something that would get people's attention, prove that we weren't yellow. Prove that we could do something valuable, contribute to the welfare of the country that wasn't destructive, or that involved maiming and killing. I think it was all of that.
So?
We were on the defense. We were very defensive.
So you jumped 12 jumps, and then the rest of the time you would be And through the winter, you did other conservation projects?
Or? Yeah. Make work projects, yes. Involved cutting a lot of firewood just to keep ourselves warm.
And did rigging take a fair amount of time?
Not in the winter. Summer it did, yes. Mm-hmm.
Were all the COs or all of your fellow jumpers riggers?
No. There must have been about 8 or 10 of us all together. I think the original crew was about 6, and they kept adding a few later on. But there's an interesting aspect of that, too. Frank Derry, of course, is our jump trainer and rigger trainer. Came down pretty hard on us because some of the guys began looking at the logs packed with every parachute to see who had packed it.
Mm-hmm.
They had more faith in some riggers than other riggers in their ability to pack it. So they began looking for the initials of their favorite rigger. And of course, Frank Derry came down pretty hard on that. He made all the jumpers quit it right away, because if you can't trust one rigger, you can't trust any of them.
So as a jumper, you didn't necessarily jump your own chute that you packed?
Well, of course some of us did, but you weren't supposed to.
Okay. Well, I know in sport parachuting, anybody packs their own main.
Yeah.
But that wasn't true in the smoke jumping. The riggers pack the mains too.
If the parachute is packed properly, it doesn't matter who packed it.
You packed the reserves, but did you ever get to see any chance where they were used? Was there any time when you were the reserves used often?
I don't recall any incident where they were used because they had to be. They were opened accidentally, occasionally. In fact, it happened to me once. I can't recall any other incident where anybody had to open their reserve. I'm so big, I had trouble getting out of the travel air. The door was so small. And I would invariably hook the top of my backpack on the top of the door, the travel air, and go spinning head over heels, which didn't make for a good opening position. And I was determined on a practice jump up there at 6 Mile to miss that doggone door. So I rolled out, and in the process of rolling, I had my arms crossed over the reserve chute. When the main chute opened, my arms pulled the D-ring of the reserve chute up and opened it accidentally. It pulled the flaps back, but the canopy stayed right there in its pack. I looked down after I checked my main canopy to make sure it was open properly, and then looked down, saw this thing ready to fall, and that can be disastrous because you aren't falling fast enough for it to catch the air, and it can come up and surround you and tangle you all up. So I quick slapped an arm down over it to keep it from falling, and then got to thinking, what's it like to have two chutes out? So I grabbed a handful of the silk and threw it as hard as I could, and it caught the air, and it's completely unmanageable. You have two chutes sticking out at a 90-degree angle. One catches the wind like a sail, and you just go with it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't manage them at all, but it was sure fun.
But you never saw a malfunction at that time.
Define malfunction.
Okay, I'm thinking of some of the things I've heard about, like May West's, the lineovers. And another word I've heard is streamer.
Yeah.
Where the chute doesn't open, but it's out of the backpack, but not open.
But every streamer I've seen has eventually opened in time. And a lineover or a May West is not that serious because it doesn't increase your rate of descent seriously at all. It looks terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It looks dangerous. I really can't tell you much about hairy situations. I've never had any trouble at all to speak of. You ought to talk to some of the guys that happened to.
you didn't see anything like that happen.
Oh, yeah, sure. We saw line overs and streamers.
Yeah.
But nothing serious. You asked about reserve chutes. Good grief, how could I forget? We were on a practice jump over 6 miles out of a trimotor. Vic Carter had asked me to take some pictures. Of course, I was unofficial photographer the whole time, aside from the jumping activities. And I was up right behind the co-pilot and trimotor, leaning out the window to get some pictures of the guys leaving the plane, their chutes opening and on the way down. We just started to use these new snap hooks, spring-loaded snap hooks that snapped onto the anchor line.
You're talking about the static line?
Static line, okay. Right. And everybody was supposedly familiar with the action of them, except Ed Carlson apparently didn't get his anchored on, didn't get it anchored into place. And the guy in front of him jumped and bounced Ed Carlson's hook off the static line. Mm-hmm. So when Ed jumped, his static line trailed out the door right after him. Mm-hmm. Earl Cooley nearly jumped right after him. He leaned so far out the door to yell at Ed to pull his emergency chute. I thought Earl was going to go right down with him. But Ed kept falling. He's kind of I guess he's gone now. A slow, good-natured, good-humored Swede. He said afterward that he was falling headfirst, and the wind caught his jacket and inflated the thing, and he couldn't find his emergency. So he finally pushed that down with one hand and found his emergency with the other hand, his D-ring with the other hand, and finally got it open. He oscillated about twice, and he was down. But everybody thought he was just going to bore right into the ground.
That's a malfunction, isn't it?
Of what? Man or equipment?
Either.
Both, yeah.
Were injuries common?
Minor injuries, I think, sprained ankles, a few broken bones, not many. I think they were very minor, nothing serious. Mm-hmm. Injuries are mainly from volleyball and project.
Okay. Now, were you still jumping when some of the returning vets were coming back?
No. No, they made a clean sweep. Let's see. 1945 was our last summer. I guess 46 was a complete change of personnel.
So you didn't get a chance to interact with any of them at all?
Not as jumpers, no. Mm-hmm. Later on as acquaintances.
Mm-hmm. How did they feel about the CPS program?
That's hard to generalize.
Again, talking about smoke jumpers. But.
I think as a generality, we got more understanding and sympathy from veterans than we did from non-veterans. Mm-hmm. The veterans' attitude seemed to be that they wouldn't do it again. A lot of their time was wasted. Maybe even
in the war?
Yes. Their time in service.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even the cause was not just. I don't know. I'm on shaky ground here. This is just a general impression they left me with.
Well, I know that, I've heard that, like the smoke jumper reunions, that the COs usually have their own. That's what I've heard.
Oh, what's the implication here?
Sure
we do.
Whether it was some sort of harsh feelings between the two groups.
Oh, no, I don't think so at all. Oh, no. It's the camaraderie, I think, that promoted that. Mm-hmm. We were a distinct segment. Warriors only. Mm-hmm. Why would a high school intermingle reunions? Why would a college? They go by classes, by years. No, I don't think there's any basis in that at all.
Well, at the end of the war, did you feel as though you wanted to keep on jumping?
Not at all.
Oh.
Not at all.
And your co-jumpers, did they seem to feel the same way, do you think? Or?
That's pretty hard to answer. Because I really don't know. I would guess that everybody felt about the way I did. They wanted to get back to their pre-war existence, back to putting a life together. They considered the war years a hiatus, an interruption.
So without the war, there wasn't really the need to prove yourselves.
Right.
In the way you were speaking.
And most of us have been 4 years without income. It was getting pretty desperate.
So, the loss of the COs was a loss to the Forest Service, but as far as you as a group, you didn't feel as though you wanted to pursue it as a career.
No, I didn't. Two of us, Bill Laughlin and I, thought seriously about setting up a rigging service somewhere in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was going to be Ohio somewhere, but that didn't amount to anything.
Mm-hmm. At the end of my tape here.
Of course, we have our own mailing list. It would be pretty hard to get the invitation out to anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, this is hard to believe.
Yeah. Well, then we had noticed that the COs that we had sent questionnaires to hadn't sent them back to the archives.
Yeah, I'm one of them.
And so that was cited as further evidence of the separation of the groups, the COs from the vets. It's interesting when you're talking about the veterans' attitudes, that they maybe were a bit unhappy with what they had done too, and might have been more sympathetic to you.
This comes as a complete surprise and shock to me.
Sometimes I've heard smoke jumpers called an elite corps. And did you have any of that feeling when you were working a fire or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. We were the creme de la creme. You bet.
And that was your attitude about yourselves, or?
Yeah. You mean, did it come from some other source?
How did the other firefighters feel about you?
That we were the best. And they resented it.
Did they debate with you as to whether smoke jumping was even needed?
No, I don't recall any discussion of that sort, no. But you've got to remember who was left to be anything other than a smoke jumper, like a smoke chaser.
Mm-hmm.
They were 4Fs. They were underage. The dregs of manhood. Just like we were. Well, let's face it. Selective service considered us unfit for military service.
Mm-hmm. I'd kind of like to come back to a question I asked earlier that fell flat on its face. That was any memorable characters that you remember and stand out.
Are you interested in names, or why they're characters, or
both?
People
that you remember that either just for certain things they did, or outstanding jumpers, or people who had unusual skills, anything.
Oh, sure, there's a whole bunch. This Bill Laughlin, I mentioned a little while ago, two of us were talking about setting up a rigging service, is an outstanding archaeologist, still is. Ed Carlson, who took a nosedive and almost killed himself, was a big, slow, fun-loving Swede. Used to take us into town in his old Chevrolet panel truck. Who else? Dave Flaccus, still here in town, has a Mountain Press Publishing Company. You probably heard of him.
What do you remember him for?
Mainly his fishing ability and his good-natured understanding of me and everything that went on. Easy to get along with. We had similar backgrounds also. Who else? Lots of faces flash by, but it's kind of hard to categorize them.
Pretty favorable impressions?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. All of them.
Working as a group, did you work well together? Or?
Oh, yes. I can't remember any unfavorable. Of course, that's my kind of memory, I guess. I think it's typical of most people. They tend to remember the pleasant incidents, not the unpleasant ones.
Now, your spotter on the flight, was he a jumper also?
Oh, yes. They were all trained jumpers. Of course, the spotters were all Forest Service personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you always have a good spot?
Every fire jump, I recall, was spotted very well, yes. The only problem I recall was on a practice jump up at Seeley Lake. A spotter had, we were jumping into a pretty high wind to begin with, and the spotter was to intentionally take us too far past the jump spot so that we would have to slip the parachute, spill part of it, in order to get down through the wind quickly. And he let us out much too early instead of too late. So I had to do just the opposite of what we were told to do, and finally made it, but he didn't.
So he...
And I won't tell you who it was.
He jumped that load too, or...?
He jumped last, yes.
Oh, so he had to...
Yes. He paid for his own mistake, yes. Because he's still here in town.
But mostly your spots were good.
Oh, yes, very good. Yeah. Forest servicemen did an outstanding job.
What was about the average altitude that you jumped out at?
It's about supposed to be 1,000 feet, but depending on the terrain and how the pilot was flying, it was pretty hard to judge. I remember one jump out of McCall, Idaho. Jungle Creek Fire, I think it was. The pilot was flying parallel to the ridge. No, excuse me. He was flying perpendicular to the ridge, so that a few seconds, plus or minus, would make a great deal of difference in the altitude which we jumped. And this spotter delayed a little too long. Not on our jump, but on the jumpers that followed us. Our spotter did an excellent job. That was Art Cochran, I think, for that jump. But whoever the spotter was for the next crew, the next jump crew that came in, waited a little too long, flying perpendicular to the ridge, so that when he finally let them go, they jumped at about 300 feet. Because their chutes just barely opened, and they were on down on the ground. We wondered if they'd make it at all, but they did, and nobody was hurt. Mm. That's the only incident I've ever seen or heard of that was that close. Mm. And of course, I guess the military jumps at 300 feet all the time. That's nothing unusual at all. The Forest Service has a great deal more respect for life and limb. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness.
Yeah, it seems as though there was quite a few innovations in parachute technology, and as a result of the parachute project, the smoke jumping project, which sport parachutists and all seem to have picked up.
Oh yes, the Army, I think it was the Army at the time, because there wasn't an Air Force, I don't think, sent a group of jumpers to jump alongside of us. It must have been the summer of 45. And I was to take pictures and drive the ambulance for the project. We were going up to it's this little clearing just the other side of Blue Mountain. Can't think of it right offhand, but we were jumping in that area. I wasn't jumping, the crew was jumping. And one of the sergeants, Army sergeants, sprained his ankle on the first jump, so he was riding with me in the ambulance, and we got to talking and comparing notes on the Army chutes and our dairy slotted chutes. This is what they were primarily interested in, this dairy steerable slot that Frank Dairy had invented. But he got to tell me some, he got to telling me some fascinating stories about jumping. He'd just been through the Anzio invasion, where Army pilots would not fly low enough in their DC-3s and expose the jumpers to ground fire on the way down. And the jump masters, who were the last ones to jump, resented this so badly that they were so high up, they would pull the pin from a grenade and throw it up in the cockpit just before they left the plane. I mean, these were their own men. It was sickening to hear about it. He also told me how to get down through power lines.
Was that ever anything you had to be concerned with?
No, we never jumped anywhere near power lines, but they did.
Yeah.
This is the irony of it, of course. He said their instructions were to keep your arms folded over your chest, keep your feet together, and turn your head to the left.
That's it?
That's it.
Okay. Don't say a prayer or anything.
No, they just expected to lose 10% of their men.
I had read something about one type of a line of firefighting technique that was invented, I guess, by the COs, and it was called the step-up technique. Did you, are you aware of that term?
I think I know what you mean.
Each person takes one part of a line and mm-hmm. works it when he connects it with somebody else,
mm-hmm.
bumps that person.
And you just keep moving on down the line. Yeah, mm-hmm. Keep digging deeper and wider.
Was that something that came out of?
I have no idea.
You used it?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I have no idea where it originated.
Well, one source I read said it originated with the COs. Uh-huh. So I was wondering if you were aware of that. Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell me about your experiences, or is there something I've neglected to ask?
You've covered the field pretty well, and I'm flattered that anybody wants to hear them.
You realize for the great majority of the population, this is a really unique experience.
Yeah, but who wants to hear about it?
I do.
Well, you're different.
there's quite a few of us involved in this project.
Oh, is that right? No, I expect to have to cudgel my grandchildren into a corner in order to tell them about.
Any other smoke jumpers in the family?
No. No. Steve is not the least bit interested. Of course, Carol wouldn't be anyway, I guess. They've never taken women, have they?
Have they? Just recently.
Oh. Yeah. What? How many? How long ago?
A couple years ago.
Oh, really? Well, it was too late for her anyway.
Now it's profitable, I suppose.
I hear the pay is pretty good, or can be, yes.
Well.
Depending on overtime.
Well, thank you very much.
I think you've covered the field pretty well.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.